Welcome to the media ministry of the Bible Church of Brownsburg. The teacher for this message is Pastor Paul Ludke.
Well, if you'll turn in your Bibles this morning to Psalm 46. Psalm 46. 500 years ago, Martin Luther was no stranger to times of turmoil and volatility. Pretty sure that Luther would feel right at home with us right now. In fact, he'd probably have a few lessons for us on it's not as bad as you think it is with what he had to experience. He lived in Germany in the middle of Europe during a time of great political upheaval, kings and kingdoms battling one another, with those that lived amongst them caught up in the middle. He lived in a time of persecution, as he was one of those that led the confrontation against the Roman Catholic theology, the error that was being spread, the false gospel, the spiritual abuse that was throughout the Western world as a result of their teachings. I even thought it was interesting as I was reading a little bit about him this week that he lived through the Black Plague, times of great and grave physical danger that affected the health of so many across the known world at that time. Luther lived in momentous times. And he had a burden to be able to bring the truths of God's word to his people, to translate it from Latin, that was not the language of the common man. Latin, the language that only the educated, only the elite would have had access to, and then to take it and provide it in the language of the people. And he devoted his life to that translation. He devoted his life to translating even the Psalms, a book that he referred to as the Bible in miniature, and these little 150 different Psalms. It's said that in times of discouragement, Luther would turn to the Psalms. In his darkest moments, that both he and his companion Philip Melanchthon, if I pronounce on that, I'm blowing it. We're going to call him Philip from now on, okay? In those darkest hours that he and Philip, his constant companion, endured, and you can imagine what they would have been like: persecution, war, plague, not knowing and having the vision that we have of how it turned out, that they would turn to the Psalms for comfort and for help and for guidance, for confidence. And in particular, this psalm, Psalm 46. And they would sing together, "A sure stronghold, our God is He, a timely shield and weapon. Our helper He will be, and set us free from every ill can happen." Now, that's not how we remember a mighty fortress is our God. That's not how we begin that song. We have translated it into those words that we are more familiar with in our day. But that song, one of the most famous hymns penned almost 500 years ago, all of the thoughts that went into that arise from Psalm 46. And that's why I think of all of the psalms that we have covered up to this point, this one especially reflects our theme of songs for the soul. This is a psalm, as they all were, but specifically, and we'll see here in a moment, was a psalm that was written to be sung. And so we have the privilege of this morning digging in a little bit deeper to see what was in this psalm that provided such help to a man such as Luther, one of the fathers of our faith, and to see if what is in here might be helpful for us during our own momentous times. Let me read this psalm to us this morning as we begin, and then we'll begin to look at it specifically in three different sections. Psalm 46, for the choir director, a psalm of the sons of Korah, set to Alamoth, a song. God is our refuge and strength, a very present help in trouble. Therefore, we will not fear. Though the earth should change, and though the mountains slip into the heart of the sea, though its waters roar and foam, though the mountains quake at its swelling pride, Selah. There is a river whose streams make glad the city of God, the holy dwelling places of the Most High. God is in the midst of her. She will not be moved. God will help her when morning dawns. The nations made an uproar. The kingdoms tottered. He raised his voice. The earth melted. The Lord of hosts is with us. The God of Jacob is our stronghold. Selah. Come, behold the works of the Lord, who has wrought desolations in the earth. He makes wars to cease to the end of the earth. He breaks the bow and cuts the spear in two. He burns the chariots with fire. Cease striving and know that I am God. I will be exalted among the nations. I will be exalted in the earth. The Lord of hosts is with us. The God of Jacob is our stronghold, Selah. Here this psalm provides three trustworthy truths for our times. Three trustworthy truths for our times. And I'm not going to ask you to say that three times fast. Three trustworthy truths for our times. The first is found in the first three verses. The power of God overcomes our panic. The power of God overcomes our panic. The second is found in verses 4 through 7. The presence of God overcomes our predicaments. The presence of God overcomes our predicaments. And the third truth, found in verses 8 through 11, the peace of God overcomes our pressures. The peace of God overcomes our pressures. Now, it doesn't take a biblical rocket science to see why you break up this passage into these verses. Did you notice the pause between each section? The Selah. That is not just a signal for the singers to catch your breath. I always needed that instruction when I'm in the choir. Like, this is the time that you can breathe. And I know Fred and Emily always tell us, like, you can breathe here, but don't breathe here. Right? It's going to sound horrible. So you got to be told when to breathe. It's not just an instruction for the singer. It's an opportunity to pause and reflect and to think on the weight of the truth that was just spoken before you just rush into the next section. And so, each section of this psalm is broken up with a Selah. Let's begin with verses 1 through 3. The power of God overcomes our panic. The power of God overcomes our panic. And we have to at least spend a few moments on these brief little descriptions that it's at the top here before we get into what our Bibles describe as verse 1 or notate as verse 1. For Those words there that you see for the choir director of the Sons of Korah sent to Alamoth, a song, that is every bit as much inspired as the words that follow. That's not an addition that came later. That's a description that goes along with the words that we see below it. So as I've said, when it mentions for the choir director a song, these are words that were designed to be sung, put to melody for a chorus of voices to call out and to proclaim. But it's also giving us information about who might have written this song, who might have put this all together. That's why it says a psalm, which is kind of in parentheses, that's kind of what we add so that we understand what's being talked about, a psalm of the sons of Korah. Now, this is the first psalm that we have come to in our series that would have the sons of Korah as potential authors. Some see it as from the sons of Korah, or for the sons of Korah, excuse me, instead of the sons of Korah. I tend to think that because there's so many, there's multiple psalms that have this same inscription, it's giving us just information that these are the ones that they wrote, not just for them. You might remember that Korah was one of the tribe of Levi that led a rebellion against Moses in the wilderness, to the point that God destroyed him and all of those who followed him. The ground opened up and swallowed them whole. So if this is of the sons of Korah, then how do you get sons if Korah was the one that led the rebellion? And, well, his sons must not have followed him in his rebellion, because there's record later on in Chronicles of that family line continuing, even though Korah and those that rebelled were swallowed up very dramatically. I think that's a great thing for us to note. I mean, some of us may have a little bit of sketchiness in our family history. And here we have a psalm that is written, and if you trace their family line back, they're not going to be too proud of great-great-great-grandpa Korah, who rebelled against Moses and was swallowed up by the earth. But in the mercy and grace of God, the sins of the father are not counted against the sons, right? Every new individual, every new generation has the opportunity, indeed the responsibility, to stand before God alone and to obey and to follow and to believe. And these sons did. They were priests of the tribe of Levi. We think they actually were given responsibilities in the tabernacle and the temple. So this is no throwaway little line here when it says the sons of Korah. And then it says, set to Alamoth. Well, what does that mean? Well, we don't know exactly, but we think it means this is a song to be sung by young virgins, meaning sopranos. This is a song that was to be sung by a particular group of people, kind of that beautiful compilation of soprano voices who gather together and then sing this truth. All of that kind of serves as the introduction to this psalm. So now let's move into the content found in verse 1, the power of God overcoming our panic. God is our refuge and strength, a very present help in trouble. It's helpful in this first verse, and really, I was tempted to just do a message on the first three verses because so much is packed into this. Everything that follows flows from the truth of verses 1 through 3, and even what's in verses 1 through 3 flows from this term and use of the word God, Elohim. This is Creator God. Elohim is the term used in Genesis 1:1. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. The picture that one is to have in their minds when they hear this name of God is His majesty and His power and His might and His strength. All that went into creation, all of the power that went into creating everything that we see, and yet the majesty of creating the beauty that surrounds us, the mind of God that went into creation is all held in Elohim. In fact, that's why we think it's plural, not just because of the fact that we serve a triune God, but because a singular word isn't enough to hold all of the majesty that should be ascribed to God. It reflects the fullness of His power, God. And then we translate in English so we understand is, like this is what, but really there's no verb in the Hebrew. It's God, our refuge and strength. This is who He is. He's a refuge. He's a shelter, a place of solace and rest, of safety and protection. When you're caught out in a thunderstorm, where do you want to find? Where do you want to go? I mean, my grandson would love to just put his rain boots on and his raincoat and just stomp around in the puddles. But when you're caught out in that kind of situation, you want to find a shelter, someplace that's going to protect you from the pelting rain. He's a shelter, a refuge. But He's not just a refuge for anyone. Look in verse 1. He's our refuge. He's a refuge for those that belong to Him. He's not just a universal shelter. He's available for those that are His. Refuge and strength, a source of unstoppable force. So a word that's used in Exodus 15:13, when the Israelites, who had been brought up out of Egypt by God, protected against the armies of Pharaoh by God, the Israelites stopped and spoke of His power. And they said, "In your loving kindness you have led the people whom you have redeemed. In your strength you have guided them to your holy habitation." God is powerful enough to both redeem His people and to bring them where they need to go. No force on earth can get in His way. But it's also a picture of a fortress. It's not just that He's unstoppable and nothing can prevent Him from doing what He wants to do. It's that He's impenetrable. He's a fortress. In Judges 9:51, the same word speaks of a strong tower that's in the center of a city, a tower that cannot be breached. That's the kind of God that is available for us. He's refuge and strength. And then the author goes to continue, a very present help in trouble. That very just magnifies all of this description of God from refuge and strength to present. He's not just present, he's very present. He's available at any point of need. He's reliable to the utmost degree. He is there for those that belong to him in all of their trouble. Trouble there is plural. It's not just one kind of trouble. It's any kind of trouble. Whatever kind of trouble you find yourself in, from adversaries to persecution, from trials to afflictions, from spiritual to physical, and you can understand why somebody like Martin Luther would appreciate just the first phrase of this psalm. Whatever trouble I find myself in, God is present. He's a source of refuge and strength. I love what that word trouble indicates to us. Really what it's referring to is a tight place. In our day and age, we might say when you find yourself caught between a rock and a hard place, right? When you're in a squeeze where you're feeling the pressure. There's an illustration of this in Exodus chapter 5. You'll remember when Moses was sent back to the Israelites, and he goes to Pharaoh and says, "The Lord's told me to tell you to set his people free." What was Pharaoh's response? "Oh, sure, go ahead, no problem." No, he had an entire slave population, right? And he wasn't going to give that labor up. And as a matter of fact, for the trouble that they put him in, that Moses put him in, for bringing this request to him, he wanted to try to exert some kind of political pressure on Moses. So what did he do? Verse 10 of Exodus 5. "So the taskmasters of the people and their foremen went out and spoke to the people, saying, 'Thus says Pharaoh, I'm not going to give you any straw. You go and get straw for yourselves wherever you can find it, but none of your labor shall be reduced.'" Up to that point, Pharaoh said, "Okay, you're making the bricks. I'll make sure you get the straw you need. You do the labor of putting the bricks together, and then we'll move forward." Now he's like, no. Guess what? Now you get to go scramble to find the straw you need. And by the way, the number of bricks that you have to provide is still the same. What do you think that did to their work day? The taskmasters pressed them, saying, "Complete your work quota, your daily amount, just as when you had straw. Moreover, the foremen of the sons of Israel, whom Pharaoh's taskmasters had set over them, were beaten and were asked, 'Why have you not completed your required amount, either yesterday or today, in making brick as previously?' Then the foremen of the sons of Israel came and cried out to Pharaoh, saying, 'Why do you deal this way with your servants? There's no straw given, yet you keep saying, make bricks. Behold, your servants are being beaten, but it's the fault of your own people.' He said, 'You're lazy, very lazy. Therefore, you say, let us go and sacrifice to the Lord. So go now and work, for you will be given no straw, yet you must deliver the quota of bricks.'" Pharaoh's got no sympathy for him. Verse 19, "The foremen of the sons of Israel saw that they were in trouble," "because they were told, 'You must not reduce your daily amount of bricks.'" You see the tightness? You see the rock in a hard place? You see the tight place that they were caught in? That's the idea here in Psalm 46. A very present help when you're in that kind of trouble. The psalmist begins by making great emphasis to focus on Almighty God, the majestic one who made the heaven and earth, the mighty one who created you, the one who's made himself available to those that belong to him as a refuge and a shelter from every storm, the one who's powerfully strong to overcome every threat or danger, the one who's continually present in every tight place. The psalmist is saying, just in verse 1, God is everything you need. He is the trustworthy object of your faith and your belief. Trust him. Trust him. God is our refuge and strength, a very present help in trouble. The psalmist starts there, and it's like this fountain that now overflows with what are the repercussions of actually believing that? What are the repercussions of trusting in that? And that's what you see in verse 2. They state the truth in verse 1, and they make what should be a very logical conclusion based on that truth in verse 2. Therefore, we will not fear. We will not fear. That's the conclusion that the sons of Korah come to and write down in this psalm. God is so powerful, we will not fear. There is no way for faith and fear to coexist together. That's what they're saying. Just like there's no way for light and darkness to coexist together. You have one or you have the other. You don't have them at the same time. And then they go into detail about the kinds of circumstances that will not cause this equation to be broken. Therefore, we will not fear, though, and here are circumstances that even when they're true, do not change this truth. Do not change that equation. Though the earth should change. The earth should change. Well, that's not hard to think about what causes the earth to change. Earthquakes, right? Earthquakes. Though an earthquake may come and completely ravage the landscape, though the world might appear to be turned upside down, even when that happens, that doesn't change the equation. Faith and fear cannot exist together. Even though the mountains slip into the heart of the sea, well, that's an earthquake that takes place in the ocean, right? And what comes of that earthquake? A tsunami. And a tsunami is a big, powerful wave that then pounds the coast and causes chunks of the mountain to fall into the sea. One of the greatest forces on earth. The authors are saying, even if that were to happen, that doesn't change the equation. Even if you had to live through a tsunami, even if that was thrown at you, that doesn't change the equation that faith and fear do not coexist together. The waters roar and foam. The noise that comes from the sea in all of its fury, the violent waves of destruction. You ever been on a beach? Not like you see in Hawaii or Tahiti, where these waves are just slowly rolling in. You can just dip your toes in and walk out for a quarter of a mile. No, where the waves are pounding. They pound into the sand and that foam that comes up because of all the pressure that gets put on and the air gets squeezed out. The loudness of the noise, it's so loud you can't even talk to the person next to you. The violence of power of the sea doesn't change anything. Though the mountains quake at its swelling pride. We think of mountains as being pictures of permanence and stability, almost a pride in the fact that mountains don't move. But even when they do, when they shake and they tremble and they break apart, even that doesn't change the equation. There's no place for fear when our faith is in God. How can there be such confidence in the midst of such geographical tumult? How can you believe that? How can you trust that? Because you believe that you're protected by the God who made it all, the God who sustains it all. Because you believe that in the God who controls every last molecule in the universe, and know that nothing happens outside of his power and control. That's how you can believe that. That's how you can have that kind of faith. He's a refuge and strength and a help, because there's nothing outside of his power or his control. You even think of the day when the earth will be completely destroyed. Well, that's just going to be a picture of his own judgment, isn't it? Even that's not outside of his control. There's even no need to fear for that, because all that means is that there's going to be a new heaven and a new earth created. There's never a moment in time, these sons of Korah are saying, that you experience anything that this earth could throw at you when faith and fear should coexist. And then he says, Selah. Pause. Think about that for a moment. Do you really believe that to be true? What's the worst thing that's happened to you that this earth has thrown at you? Does it cause your faith in God to be shaken? The singers catch their breath. Now that they've sung this chorus that speaks of natural disaster, they then focus on what might seem to hit maybe a little bit closer to home. What happens with the nations seem to be against us? What happens when there's national peril? That's what the focus is on in verse 4 going forward. The power of God, first of all, overcomes our panic. That panic that we might get when we hear of the earth shaking. Now, the presence of God overcomes our predicaments. The presence of God overcomes our predicaments. There is a river whose streams make glad the city of God, the holy places of the Most High. God is in the midst of her. She will not be moved. God will help her when the morning dawns. What kind of river is the author talking about? A stream that makes glad the city of God. What's he referring to, or they're referring to, when they talk about the city of God? Jerusalem, right? Jerusalem. Jerusalem, if I don't know if you've ever visited there or read about it, Jerusalem is not a place where there are just streams everywhere. It's not like the Tigris and the Euphrates next to Jerusalem. There's a spring called the Spring of Siloam that originally sat just a little bit outside of the walls of Jerusalem, and then as the city grew, was brought into the city itself, that provides all of the fresh water that is needed for the city. We're familiar with the Pool of Siloam, right? From the New Testament when Jesus is healing, but it's the Spring of Siloam that provides that water for Jerusalem. And what's being pointed to here is this river, these streams that are able to branch out and provide refreshment and provision for all who are there. It's really pointing to, for those of us that were in Family Bible Hour this morning, it's pointing to the river that flows from the New Jerusalem, that stream that just bursts forth in the New Jerusalem. There's a river whose streams make glad the city of God, because it's there, it's always there. It's peace that's pictured by this river. It's a reminder that God's with you. He's there, the holy dwelling places of the Most High, Jerusalem, where God himself is. Where God is present, the psalmist is saying, your needs will be amply supplied. He's in the midst of the city, therefore the city will not be moved. Not only where God is present will you be amply supplied, but where God is present, you'll be amply protected. You'll have stability in the midst of worldwide chaos. What they're saying here is when you trust in God, when you obediently follow him, there's no predicament that could come up that would ever cause you concern. Be anxious for nothing, right? By prayer and supplication, make your requests be made known to God. There's no national crisis in which there's now an exception and now it's okay to fear. That's what they're saying. God is in the midst of his people. God will help the city. God will help her when the morning dawns. And that's what we read in 2 Kings 19 today, right? Hezekiah, concerned about the king of Assyria bringing his army, 185,000 soldiers that were going to overcome the city of Jerusalem. He prays to the Lord. Isaiah tells him the answer to his prayer. And when the morning dawns and they go out to check to see what happened to the army, poof, they're dead. The king tucks tail and heads back home. Soon enough, he's dead too. At the dawn, at the moment when the attack is about to come, picture yourself sitting on the walls of Jerusalem, waking up, looking, and all you can see outside the walls are an army that has surrounded, an army that looks the strongest and the fiercest in that moment because the battle has not been engaged yet. God says, that's the moment that I'm there. When you might be tempted the most, that's when I am present. When you might be fearful of your predicament, he's saying, I am there. Martin Luther also said this in talking to his friend Philip. If we perish, Christ must fall too. He is in the midst of us. And if it be so, be it so. I would rather perish with Christ, that great ruler of the world, than prosper with Caesar. Oh, that we would have that same kind of mindset. I would rather perish with Christ than prosper with Caesar. The authors continue in verse 6, the nations made an uproar, the kingdoms tottered. He raised his voice and the earth melted. Think of how vulnerable it is to live in the nation of Israel. We know how vulnerable they are today, right? They're this little democracy, right, that follows the Jewish tradition in the midst of a Middle East that is completely Muslim. Israel has never been secure on its border, ever. To the north, right, they've got the Assyrians. To the south, they've got the Egyptians. To the east, they've got the Babylonians. There was never a point in time where Israel was secure, yet no nation can stand against the voice of God. No army can be raised that can withstand his word. No assembled force can survive the execution of his will as he speaks it. He raised his voice. The earth melted. Now this chorus ends with this refrain. The Lord of hosts is with us. The God of Jacob is our stronghold. And I want to just take a moment because you'll notice that it's repeated in verse 11 just to cover all that's meant here in verse 7. This refrain, and it's the Lord of hosts. It's going back to this theme, a very present help in trouble. The Lord of hosts is with us. This is the ruler of the army of angels. This is the king of the heavenly host that's ready to move at his command. You might remember, you can write this down. I won't go there. Our time is getting away from us this morning. But you might remember the story in 2 Kings 6 of Elisha, and how the king of Assyria again was trying to go after Israel, and he kept getting thwarted, and his servant said, well, the reason why you're getting thwarted is because Elisha is able to know what you think even in your most private quarters. And so he sends his army after Elisha, and Elisha's servant goes out and sees this whole army. Well, what are we going to do, Elisha? Elisha prays, Lord, give him eyes to see. And he opens his eyes, and what does he see? The army of the Lord that is surrounding and protecting them. He is the Lord of hosts that is with us. He's the Lord of the army that no one can see. He's the one that at the snap of a finger could wipe out any group, no matter how powerful they might think, no matter how many weapons that they might have. It just takes a word from him. And then he's also the God of Jacob. I just think this is so personal. To think of the God of heaven and the heavenly host is also the God of Jacob. Jacob was that guy that lived that life that you kind of read his story in Genesis and you're like, God, why did you pick him? I mean, why was he the one that you decided to keep your promise? He was the grandson of Abraham, but he doesn't seem to live a very righteous life, especially at the beginning, right? It's all about himself. He's tricking his brother and his mother and his father in order to gain birthrights. He wrestles with God. He gets tricked into marrying two sisters. He's got 12 male heirs and more children beyond that. Children that are going to be loyal to their mothers, which then is going to create a very interesting family dynamic, don't you think? So you've got conflict there. Often a pariah goes back to the promised land, is afraid his own brother is going to kill him. His kids slaughter an entire town, forces him to move and become a vagabond all across and through the promised land. He loses his favorite son, thinks he's left for dead, or thinks he's dead. His own sons know the difference and don't tell him. Loses his love of his life at an early age. Suffers through famine, only to discover that his favorite son is alive, but that to be with him and to be preserved, he's going to have to leave the land of promise and go live among the Egyptians. He was a vagabond. He was somebody that needed help. He was someone that needed a refuge. He was someone that needed a God that was present. He is not just the Lord of hosts, he's the God of Jacob. Jacob who would become Israel. The God of Jacob is our stronghold. That's the one that we put our trust in. That's the one that we run to for protection. That's the tower that preserves us. Selah. He's in the midst of us. He's not just powerful. He's with us. And then in verse 8, our third truth, not just that the power of God overcomes our panic and the presence of God overcomes our predicaments, the peace of God overcomes our pressures. Peace of God overcomes our pressure. Is there any greater pressure that we might face on earth than war? We're seeing it played out on our phones and social media and television screens in these moments. Is there anything that brings about more pressure on an individual or a nation or a group of people than war? And here the peace of God overcomes our pressures. Come, the authors say, come, behold the works of the Lord. Stop, think, consider. It's so easy for us to skip this, isn't it? So easy for us to just jump over this part and become overwhelmed by what we perceive to be impossible all around us, rather than stopping and thinking of what has God done as opposed to what have men done. Come, behold the works of the Lord. You're being called to be a witness in that statement. Look and see and observe. Watch. Who has wrought desolations in the earth. I love what one author said. God is the destroyer of the destroyers. God is the destroyer of the destroyers. The worst kind of people and power, the greatest wickedness that we can observe on this earth that seeks out the death and destruction of other men and women and children, the worst of the worst, God destroys them. They can't touch God. God is the one that takes care of them. He's the victor. He's the winner. He never loses. Verse 9, he makes wars to cease to the end of the earth. He breaks the bow and cuts the spear in two. He burns the chariots with fire. You realize the one who wins the battle is the one who dictates the terms for peace. This is not just some kind of negotiation. Well, I'm kind of tired of the battle and I'm kind of tired of the battle. Let's just compromise and figure out a way for us to live at peace with one another. No, this is complete domination. This is unconditional surrender. Saying God is the victor, and therefore he determines the terms for peace. He ends the conflict. He destroys the tools of war. That's what's happening there in verse 9. He has won the battle, so the war is over. There's no place on earth that he can't reach. He breaks the bow. He cuts the spear in two. He burns the chariots with fire. Those instruments of death are broken and burned, never to be used again. It's said that Vespasian, the Roman emperor, when he ended his wars in Italy and abroad, had a medal made to reflect his victory. This medal showed a goddess of peace that in one hand held an olive branch, right? We understand olive branch represents peace, right? And in the other hand held a torch. That torch was being used to light on fire all of the instruments of war so that it would become an ash heap. The winner of the war and the battle gets to destroy all the instruments of war so they can never be used again. That's the one who establishes true, real peace. It's a demonstration of complete control, total sovereignty, absolute victory, permanent peace. So what's the response then to this kind of peace? And that's what we see in verse 10. Cease striving. Cease and know that I am God. I'll be exalted among the nations. I'll be exalted in the earth. Stop and worship God, the psalmist is saying. He's not just the God of the heavens. He's the one who is exalted on heaven, in heaven and on earth. He's the one whose will be done in heaven and on earth. Even God's enemies will have to bow to him. Echoes the words of Psalm 4:4, tremble and do not sin. Meditate in your heart upon your bed and be still. God is powerful, he is present, and he is the author of peace. Selah. The Lord of hosts is with us. The God of Jacob is our stronghold. Selah. Think of his resources. Think of the application of his care towards those that belong to him. You can remember, believer, that when you think you're weak, you're strong. When you think you're poor, you're rich. When you think you're low, you're raised high. When you're afflicted, you're comforted. Why? Because you don't find your refuge and your strength and your help in yourself. You find it in God. There's nothing new under the sun. There's no conflict that we will engage in that has not been engaged in before. But the resources of God are infinite and available to all men who bow the knee to Him. There's nothing outside of His control. There's a good that can come out of war. It's that when we see the hardship and conflict of war, we can be reminded of the blessings of peace. And we can remember that God is the one who brings true and final and eternal peace. He's with us. This is a psalm that people of God have clung to since the days it was written. I saw a little anecdote this week. I wasn't able to go back and source it out, but I kind of remember, I think, a little bit of the story that was shared as the bombs began to fall in Ukraine. I saw a little anecdote from a pastor who had been given the privilege of going back to serve and minister to the saints in Ukraine at a little seminary. And he had been brought in to help train the students on a particular topic. And when he was done, he noticed the pictures that were on the back of the wall. Individual men, very serious men in these pictures. And underneath the pictures was a little inscription, and it was obviously written in Cyrillic in a language that he didn't understand. And so he had his translator come back with him and say, tell me, what does this say? Who are these men? And the translator said, oh, it says, obey your leaders and submit to them, for they keep watch over your souls as those who give an account. Do this with joy and not with grief, for it would be unprofitable to you. It was a call to honor these men. He's like, well, who are these men? They said, oh, these have been the presidents of this particular seminary. And you can see the more recent pictures, but really focus on those that were from this period of time. Because this is when we were under communist rule. Every single one of the men that you see in those decades gave their life as payment for this position. Every single president was hunted down and killed by the communists for fulfilling that role. And the translator said, and I want you to know that when asked, no one ever turned it down, even though it came with a death sentence. And I thought, those were men who believed in Psalm 46:1. God is our refuge and strength, a very present help in trouble.
You have been listening to a message from the Bible Church of Brownsburg. For more information, please visit our website at www.bcb.church or call 317-852-7475.